and the sound of Charlottesville's own Spit It Out, Inc. coming out over the 94.7 WPBC airways at 10 o'clock can only mean that it's time for yet another episode of Homegrown, a show about local art. We are here with your host, the great lady of the radio, Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Good morning, Clint. Well, that was a lovely introduction. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. How are you doing this morning, Leslie?
I have had 4 hours of sleep and only one cup of coffee. Don't mess with me this morning.
Oh, my. Oh, my. I wonder if I should stand on the other side of the room. 4 hours of sleep? Is that how hard you New Year's Eve partied? I just have to know. Were you rocking and not clocking for all that time?
I took breaks, but you know, you gotta do what you gotta do. You know, when it comes down to it, it's a new year, and you know, you gotta bring it in with some class. You gotta go for the gusto. You know me, I go big or go home.
I do know that, and I'm constantly impressed with that. Well, we should start the show the way we always start the show, with a parental advisory, because we care. We care, and we are right there. At some point in the show, we may say the word frenulum. Frenulum. Oh, my. That word may just pop out at any moment.
Okay. You may have to start saying the word and then telling people what it means if you're going to start with, you know, these kind of words.
It's bad enough that the word may happen. To actually define it, don't you know that this is America? Ignorance is our only shield. You can't look the devil too closely in the eye, or else he'll get the prescription in your contacts.
Oh my God!
Really? I think that's from John.
Really?
I think that's from the Book of John.
You've read the Bible that closely. You're quoting scripture now.
I think so.
Alrighty.
John 5:32-8:67-5.
Okay, stop.
That was John 8:67-5:309. That's that one. If you stare at the devil too closely in the eye, he'll get the prescription of your contacts.
You need to stop right now, because we are going to get hate mail. Stop.
Well, then best we turn to someone whom you cannot hate. Our first guest today, we're so pleased to have him. He's a singer, songwriter, musician. You've got your trio. You're also part of the group Eddie from Ohio. You're here as a solo artist today.
And we're a friend of Bedalium.
And we are so pleased. There you go.
Worked it in.
There you go.
Had to look. I had to Google it.
See, do you see now what you do? This is the trouble you cause.
Michael Clem, welcome very much to Homegrown.
Hey, Clinton. Leslie, great to be here. Thanks for having me on this beautiful Sunday morning.
We are so happy you could join us.
Ditto.
So you know, most people probably know you from Eddie from Ohio.
Good. The band members of Eddie from Ohio.
Well, yeah. Well, let's hope they know you. Let's hope you don't walk on stage and be like, who's this guy? But he can play. I guess we'll let him stay. So tell us about your solo career. Like, how did that morph? How did that come about?
Well, I'm not going to say I'm new to the area. I moved down here 7.5 years ago from Northern Virginia, where we were based for the last 25 years. And it was synchronized with the time the band was slowing down. We've never broken up. We've just ramped down our schedule to be more a part-time act. And in moving down here with that lighter schedule, it kind of forced my hand to get involved in different acts. And so there's the solo thing. I haven't really done the solo too much. I just started jumping into other bands, whether they asked me or not. It's a good, you know, trial by fire. And but it's a great town down here. It's a very rich artistic community, great musicians, friendly, sharing, and wonderful folks. So it's very easy to kind of fall into those tributaries, and it's quite incestuous, too. You doesn't take long before you've met just about everybody in the music circles down here.
It is a small town, both geographically and artistically.
Yeah, deceptively small. I learned early on you really need to behave yourself. Stuff can come back to haunt you in no time.
Yes, yes, that's very true.
Yeah, like this radio show, for instance.
We have to be so careful that we don't step on anybody's toes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. No. Let's clarify that. Clinton has to be careful that he doesn't step on anybody's toes because he's worried about that. I don't care.
And thus the balance in the relationship.
What listeners don't appreciate here is how aerobic your co-hosting is. They're doing this around. They're doing their thing around one mic, and it's just beautiful Arthur Murray dance that's happening. And toe stepping could happen.
Hey, you never know. Just, you know, like I said, it's been a rough morning already. Just don't get in my way.
I just put a swelfie on Facebook. Selfie that's really friendly, so yeah, a swelfie. So people get an idea of what's actually going on here. May I get my own microphone, though?
Yeah, there you go. Well, you're the guest. Well, you're the guest.
And you're treating me
well.
You
are special. Aww. We want you to feel like you are home here on Homegrown.
Feels so home.
So what's it been like playing with these, especially after being with a particular band for so long? What's it been like playing with other musicians?
There's a learning curve there at a number of different levels. I've stepped into more supporting roles. Eddie from Ohio's been like the Marx Brothers for 25 years. There's five front people. I mean, not a wallflower in the bunch. You know, Eddie might lay low back in percussion, but, you know, we've got a bell in every tooth up there in the three. And I'm stepping into acts where I'm not the front man anymore, sharing front man duties. I learned to sort of learn humility and how to ramp down that dynamic and just, you know, play the parts. And that took some learning to do, mostly from being fired. No, that has not happened, but all good relationships. But also the work ethic of each band is different, the practice ethic. And I said in another interview that was asking about Eddie from Ohio, I really have a heightened appreciation for how we've gone about our career and our playing and making music. And just from practicing and working up songs, I mean, I realize what a drill sergeant our vocal coach is. I don't want to name her. I'll protect her anonymity, but she is a member of the group. No, but Julie is. I really appreciate what she's done with the group as far as forcing her in to really get tight harmonies and everything. And things can be a little more laissez-faire down here and casual. And I go, well, aren't we going to practice that more than once? Nah, sounds good. Just roll with it.
No, I have several musician friends, and some of them they've been friends of mine since high school. Mm-hmm. And this one particular group that I'm thinking of, it's a mixture. It's some of my friends from high school, and then other people have kind of joined the mix as
a musical
they've grown.
Band?
Yeah.
Have I played with them?
Probably not.
No.
But that is the one thing that everyone comments to me about is, you know, how do you manage your rehearsal schedule with your work schedule, with your life schedule, mm-hmm. you know? And what happens is, you know, two guys in the band just had a kid and rehearsal is like, what? Wow. Dude, there's baby.
Oh, yeah.
And I just can't.
I didn't even scratch the surface on that aspect, but that's another thing that, I might have also taken for granted is that from the get-go, when we started as four single people without spouses or kids, we threw ourselves into the full-time music thing. So there wasn't challenges of getting together. No one had to clear their work schedule because it was our 9-to-5. It was our job. And we had contemporaries, friends of ours who had their feet in both worlds, the work world and the playing world, and would bemoan how tough it is to collect everyone and work schedules, commitments, family, everything you just said there. I'm finding that out now is it's how tough it is to corral people. And every excuse under the book can keep people from gigs or practices or whatever you need to do, recording, because life happens.
Right, right. And I think that one of the other aspects of the Charlottesville arts community regardless of which art you're talking about. And one of the great things about the show is we get to peek into different artistic venues and different artistic worlds. Leslie and I mostly come from a writing and theater world, and so we get to talk to other artists and find out where the worlds are different, where they're similar. But I think one thing we get a lot of in this town is life comes in a whole heck of a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Thankfully, it seems fairly manageable because commutes are so short.
Exactly.
Compared to Philly and D.C. and markets we've come from. I mean, our idea of a traffic jam here is, you know, 29, but everywhere else is pretty clear.
Right. So talk about the trio. How much is that a part-time or
very,
full-time
very band? Part-time, but those two guys, Rusty and Thomas, who were very big on the album project and will be part of my release date this weekend, we got together. It was neat how that group came together because I had a desire to get an act going after playing with other people so often. I had kind of an itch to get my own music out there. I needed a vehicle to do that. I didn't necessarily want to do it solo, but I really love for the acoustic folk thing and wanted to get some kind of combo to do that. I've known Rusty for 20 some odd years from his group, Spital Goodrich, Gog and Lily, and
I actually know Rusty.
Did you? Oh, who doesn't know Rusty? He's next to Thomas Jefferson. I think he's probably most recognizable in town, and I think height has a little to do with that too. So I've known Rusty for a while. We've started jamming together a little bit, and then I forged a friendship with Thomas Gunn, who through theater I saw him in the Hank Williams story at the Live Arts. He had a bit part there, playing bass in that ensemble. We hit it off right away, and we started this mutual admiration society practice, meeting every Tuesday and swapping songs. He and Rusty didn't know each other, but I pulled them both into the trio because Thomas was playing upright bass and a very, very able guitarist as well. And Rusty was a great picker. Pulled those guys into together, and they hit it off well, and we just musically it really fell together with harmonies and playing and whatnot. And I had a bunch of songs that finally had a vessel. Yeah, we've been plodding along for the last 5-6 years. We probably could be a little more ambitious, but you know, that life thing comes in because Rusty and Thomas are pulled in different directions as well. And we find the windows when we can, and it's great when it does come together. It's one thing, every time we do a show, we look at each other like, we should do this more often. And it doesn't happen with every actor, so we should do this seldom. We shouldn't do this as much. But not with those guys. They're at buckets of talent there.
You dread when you get to the place where it's, are we doing this again?
What am I doing with my life?
Yeah. Why am I here with you guys?
I hate you and you ruined my life. I mean, pass the sugar. Yes.
So, if I may take advantage of your experience to ask a question that is burning me, all right, or has been burning me. So, I love folk music. I really do. But, unless you're talking about, say, Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly, or even the next generation, or like Pete Seeger, I don't know. I would be hard-pressed to actually say what modern folk music is. I even had a friend recently, he tried to introduce me. Have you heard of this? He tried to introduce me to something called anti-folk. And he played a song for a couple songs for me, and I said, well, that just sounds like folk music to me. I don't know what that means.
Do you remember the artist?
I unfortunately, I don't remember the artist. Mm.
Can you hum a few bars? What made it anti-folk?
I think Leslie went through a few bars last night.
You know what? That was not kind, and I will repay you for that in some way, shape, or form before this show is over.
All right, then.
There you go. One
There's your of friend of Adelia right there. I've massacred that word by now, haven't I? It's But anti-folk, I'm intrigued myself because I haven't heard. I've heard lots of other words to describe folk that aren't polite, but anti-folk I haven't heard. Industrial folk. We've been playing with lots of things hyphenated with folk over the years to sort of describe the Eddie from Ohio sound. Folk is a kind of a root word that can branch out, and it seems like the hub of the bicycle and the spokes go in every direction. It feeds off to jazz, country, bluegrass, even hip-hop and rap from the lyrical sense, because folk is very, it concentrates very much on the words, maybe more than other genres do.
It does, doesn't it? It seems like if there's one thing that I would have to point for folk is that the songs really have to say something.
Yeah, it's lyric based, and I've been pretty steeped in a lyric based type of music most of my career, at least when it comes to playing original music, because I've got enough skills to get by with a guitar, but I'm not going to carry a whole evening playing solo guitar pieces or any other instrument for that matter. It comes down to the voice, and because I don't sing like Pavarotti or whoever, the Michael Bublé, it really comes down to the words and what's going to get people's attention. So that's lyrical content's kind of what I lean on mostly.
Cool. 15 minutes past the hour. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. If you're just tuning in and wondering at the specifics of the bounty that you have discovered, we're sitting here with Michael Clem. You have a CD coming out.
Yes, sir.
Indeed. What's it called?
A folk CD. It's called 50 Clementines. It's my second solo CD. The first one was called First in 40. I put out on the occasion of my 40th birthday. It's been 10 years.
I was wondering. I said, you know, it seems like there's a pattern here.
Yeah, there is a pattern. And I work great with deadlines, apparently. And I let 10 years lapse with the idea, yeah, I should do another solo album because that last one was so fun. And the name didn't happen right away, but I think people are anticipating, what are you going to call it, Second and 50? You're going to call it Second and 50? I think I need to be a little more creative than that. And it all stemmed, and here's the product placement part of my plug here.
Okay.
No, I'm a stocking stuffer in last year's Christmas for my brother was a tube of Plow and Hearth's Clementine lip balm. And I should have brought a tube for both of you, but I'll drop it by later in the week.
That would be the most creative merch, I think, ever.
Well, last name being Clement, and that was clever. And sure enough, it was scented like a Clementine orange. And I thought, my album's entirely crowdfunded, and you try to find little gifts and rewards for people to give back that won't break your bank too much. And I thought, lip balm, that should be cost effective. Fair enough, but it really isn't. If you've ever bought a tube of that stuff, but they cut me a break at Plow and Hearth. And so that was a giveaway. But I thought, wow, that's not a bad name for an album. And the whole idea of the orange, the citrus thing took shape, and the color scheme, which people have attributed to UVA, but I'm a JMU guy, so sorry to break your hearts, people, but just a coincidence there. But it's a nice color scheme, blue and orange. And
it is. It's a nice cover. If you go to our Facebook page, mm-hmm. You'll be able to see a picture of it.
Yes. Oh, really? Thank you very much for the plug. And michaelclem.com's plastered all over there.
There you go.
So, yeah, that's coming out this Tuesday online for all the usual parties, iTunes, Amazon, and CD Baby. And then I'll have the release date locally at the Southern this Friday, then go back up to Northern Virginia for another release show at Jam and Java. But really gearing up for the Friday show. It's going to be a lot of fun with a four-piece band behind me, Thomas Rusty and Maddie Metcalf and Paul Rosner.
Oh, flesh out the band. I know Maddie. Maddie's great.
Maddie's a neighbor of mine, a good friend. And he and Paul, we play together every Monday at the local with the songwriter night. And so I'm just like combining two bands, my Monday night band and the trio. So it's getting supersized and joining forces.
That's great. Let's hear something from 50 Clementines.
Back of the pillow, warmer in it. Cause I feel like John Donne. Shake my fist at the rising sun. You're busy, I'm still dizzy. It's still
That was John Donne from Michael Klemm's upcoming solo CD, his second solo CD, 50 Clementines. John Donne. Is that about John Donne?
John Donne, the poet. Yeah, inspired
our favorite sesquipedalian poet.
You hijacked my word. He hijacked it. Yes, excellent use there. I don't know if he uses the words as big as yours, Clinton.
Well, Clinton, that's all you have is big words, right?
Ooh. Mostly malapropisms, mix up on the spot.
See, did I tell you I would get you back? Don't pull the tiger's tail, man.
Don't tug the frenulum, is that what you're saying?
Tiger's tail. Don't be an SO is what she's trying to say. Or Exxon. I'm getting feedback already on the show here. What was our last question there? John Donne? Whatever. Opening track.
He got distracted by our little friendly repartee.
So one of the things that I've noticed about your music, which strikes me and impresses me, is that you'll talk about anything, and I think that's the folk aspect of it. Like so much of the music is really accessible and really nice, and there are a lot of songs where there's a nice tension between a very melodic and accessible tune, but the subject matter will not be so calm.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know what to say to that, except, yeah, you're right. Well done. Next question. That wasn't even a question.
I'll throw the question. Is that intentional? Is that something that you think about?
I have always felt challenged to be creative in the lyrical sense, that stay away from cliches as best as I can. And there's no shortage of love stories out there, love songs, or love novelists, right, Leslie?
Oh, there you go.
There's more product placement for you. Coming out soon on Amazon.com. Daniel Steele?
Yes.
What's your pen name again?
I don't use a pen name. It's my name.
All right. Yeah, we're fellow artists here, shilling each other's wares.
And why not?
Clinton, you selling anything? Lawnmower, perhaps? But there's something wrong with love songs, but to quote John Gorka, who quoted Paul Simon or Richard Thompson, I can't remember that. It's okay to write a love story, but the challenge is what's the perspective? Changing the perspective, because so many things always come back to love. Even John Donne, in some demented way, probably does, and whatever other song you're going to play.
Right. There's a song that Paul Simon wrote that's on his album Hearts and Bones, which is a song about the moon, which seems to talk about his songwriting philosophy for that album, but also in general, which is basically, how do you write a song? And the song is basically, how do you write a song about love? Write a song about the moon, right? How do you write a song about this?
Yep.
Write a song about something else.
Yeah. That's a great, and there's the metaphor route, or there's just what you said there. I guess it ultimately comes down to metaphor. It's just a metaphor for something else.
And people are going to read into what you do, whatever they are, whatever their perspective is. You know, they're going to put their stamp on it.
I love that. I love it when people wrap their own meanings around it, because it saves you the burden of explaining it. Like, no, that it's
there
right.
You go.
And they can do what Clinton says. They can basically tell you, and they go, yeah, that's right.
Yes, that's exactly what I meant. Oh, my God. You are a genius.
You are an empath. Yes. Very insightful.
Okay, there's another song on this album that I absolutely have to play, because the title of it is so amazing.
Really, really, we can't keep you away from this song, can we? There's just no way.
She hasn't even heard it.
Okay, the next song off of Michael Clem's second solo album, 50 Clementines.
Saturday, I ain't got no gift. The Crate and Barrel on the way. I'm running late to the chapel. I'll slip in a back pew and hide. I accidentally slam the door, spoil the entrance of the bride. The ceremony and reception are 50 miles apart. I should have blown off the ceremony and hit the party from the start. I like the ones with open bar. Well, them's the ones I would even crash. I order me a whiskey sour. That's when they hit me up for cash. Turns out the meal is seated. Now I'm sat with the priest and elderly folk. And I have to speak to them quite loudly. Don't get any of my jokes. I try to sit in with the band, and they push me off the stage. I'm sweet talking to the flower girl, but I don't think she's of age. Hey, that girl in white looks pretty hot. She looks familiar, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, turns out that she's the bride, so I guess that means she's taken. I make a move in on the bridesmaids. I raise a glass to all our health. They start to sense my desperation. They also sense my lack of wealth. They're making a fuss over the ring boy. He gets to sit upon their knee. He couldn't be more than 4 or 5. And he's getting more than me. It's another damn wedding. Another wasted. A Crate and Barrel on the way. Why the hell am I here?
All right, Leslie, should I give you the pleasure of telling us what the title of that song was?
Not Another Wedding. I love it.
Another damn wedding.
I love it.
Are you allowed to say damn?
I absolutely love it, because you may not know this about me. Most people who know me do.
You're a wedding planner.
I have a problem with that certain M word. It's just, you know, I've done it.
Yeah.
Not for me.
Matriculation? Is that?
Monogamy. I mean, yeah. No. You know, it's just, yeah. I've done it. I tried it. Not necessarily my cup of tea.
It didn't take.
And I don't really feel the need to link myself legally to another person, you know, sanctioned by whatever state or principality I happen to live in at the time. I just don't.
Look at the size of that rabbit hole. Let's.
Yeah, the phone line just went dead all the minute, all of a sudden there. There are a lot of suitors there that just kind of went away. Gosh, phone lines were lighting up there for a moment.
Oh, no. There's always a list.
By the way, Leslie will be my date this Friday. If you'd like to meet her.
I would love to.
She will be signing my CDs. I'll be signing her book. And we'll both be signing your body parts. Bring your own Sharpie.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on our show. Michael Clem, the CD is 50 Clementines. You can hear some of these songs and more songs at your concert. Tell them when that concert is again and where.
It's going to be at the Southern Music Hall, downtown Charlottesville, right off the mall, this Friday night, 8 o'clock. Thomas Gunn, who's also in band, will be opening. He is not to be missed. He is one of the best underappreciated talents of Charlottesville in the singer-songwriter category. This Friday, 8 o'clock at the Southern. Be there, be square. Album goes on sale online this Tuesday. You go to iTunes or CD Baby and find it there.
There you go. Get it or regret it. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks, Clayton. And Leslie.
All right, 30 minutes after the hour, we're sitting here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you're listening to Homegrown, a show about local art. Stay tuned after this, of course, for our good friend Rick Moore with the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Today's guest, Sarah Ellis from the Shelter for Help and Emergency, one of the greatest organizations we have going on in town. If you want to help somebody out in 2016, help out the Shelter for Help and Emergency. And if you think you need some help, give them a call. Give them a call. They can certainly give you some. They have a 24-hour hotline, and they are, can be an invaluable resource if you need someplace to go, if you're in an abusive relationship, or if you just need someone to talk to. Anyway, Shelter for Help and Emergency.
I think I'm in an abusive relationship with you, Clinton.
I don't think you should joke about that. That was the, I think we found our line.
And I was the one to cross it. And awesome.
Surprisingly enough, you were the one who was over it. I did not expect that to happen. Later on, this afternoon, stay tuned, 4 o'clock, it's Club Del Sabor with DJ Conitro, Charlottesville's only locally produced Spanish language show featuring the music of America Latina. Hey, Leslie, I think it's time for us to go to our second guest. Or should we?
And
should
here we are with our two guests, Jim Respis and Steve Fishman. How are you guys doing?
Okay. I'm doing pretty well, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on our show.
We're happy to be here.
Great, great, great. So we want to talk to you about a show. So first off, let me ask you this question, just a question in terminology, because we come from a theater background mostly, although Leslie does a whole lot of writing, and so I'm used to talking about shows. But for visual art, do you talk about a show going up, or do you talk about an exhibit going up? Am I using the right term?
Yeah, what we're doing here, this is sort of the culmination of probably a year and a half worth of conversations that Steve and I have been having about getting together. We went to graduate school together at VCU. Steve was in painting and printmaking, and I was in the sculpture department, and we both survived. A little worse for the wear.
Yeah, you do kind of
changed a little bit.
You do kind of survive that program. I also went to VCU in theater department, so I feel your pain.
Yeah, I tell people that I'm a better artist for having gone, but I'm probably not as nice a person as I was.
Well, you know, that's how it happens.
I hear such things about VCU. It sounds like an artistic pressure cooker over there.
It really is. But they push you really hard. And he's right. You do come out a better artist. You just can't put up with any kind of crap at all.
Well, one of the things that I feel is that I am, and I guess I figured this out about 6 months, it's a year or two after I got out of there, that there wasn't anything that anybody could say about my work that scared me. I mean, and that's not saying my work's any good. I mean, I don't know if it's any good, but I'm perfectly content if people really don't like it. It's like, okay, well, now tell me why. And that's a harder question to answer rather than just the thumbs up, thumbs down, I like it, I don't like it. It's like, okay, well, tell me why.
And I think that's part of what the arts program at VCU really taught us is, you know, you do your best to create it, and then you are secure enough in what you have created that you can hear criticism and not take it personally, not internalize it.
Yeah, the criticism idea from the French critique is something that really, I think, scares a lot of people. But what it really grows is a dialogue about the ideas. And if the ideas, if somebody groks the ideas, if they can grasp them, what you want is that kind of dialogue, not a thumbs up or thumbs down. And
right.
When I was when I was in that program, one of the things that I learned was I could almost read from the people I was working with who was getting the ideas, you know, and who, who was getting the ideas and who wasn't. So I think, I don't know. I think Shakespeare would get rap, but I don't think, Robert Frost would. and that's okay, but it just tells you, like, you want to talk to a rap guy, Mr. Poet, rather than Robert Frost. Or, I mean, depending on, of course, what you're making.
Right, right. But don't you guys find that it's so rare that you get from professional critics that type of conversation about the ideas, that type of helpful back and forth that you're talking about?
Well, I think it's so process-based that when you say professional critics, I wonder if it's like, well, I'm going to deem your work successful or not. I get it or I don't get it. And what I'm much more interested in is the work kind of in progress, the raw
nice.
Part of the work, and the ideas that get grown from that.
Yeah, one of the things that Steve and I have been talking about for a long time, I mean, we both got out of VCU back in 89. So
20th century.
Ah, the 20th century. I remember it well.
So we've been doing this for a while. But one of the conversations that we've been having is about the process that we're both involved in. We come from very different positions. Steve is Steve has much more finesse than I probably will ever have in my life. And it's a wonderful thing. And I'm coming from, let me back up. It seems to me that his work comes out of working this process of making and responding to the cues that he's getting from the work. Where I'm coming from is I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy, and so the ideas are driving what I'm trying to do. And I'm literally now learning things that I probably should have learned 30 years ago.
So tactile learner meets theoretical learner.
Right, right. Yeah. And three-dimensional artist works with two-dimensional artist, right?
Yeah.
I think that's just looking at what the pictures you've shown us of some of the pieces, I think that's what is really appealing to this whole thing, because you do get both sides of that. And so people who are tactile learners and people who aren't will be attracted to both of it and understand both sides of it.
Yeah. So in putting up this joint exhibit, were you looking for your pieces to have a tension with each other, or were you looking for the pieces to complement each other? What did I just stumble into?
Awesome. There's a lot of laughing going on. Wait.
Why don't you take that one, Steve?
Well, thank you, Jim.
I think I asked the right question.
Let me climb into the traffic copter and see what we can figure out here. Oh, we got a little traffic jam here. No, we've been, Jim and I, over the last probably 2 years, have been doing a studio Skyping. My studio's in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's at the McGuffey Center here in Charlottesville. And we've been using technology to sort of look at, to help each other. I guess at first the show grew out of this, of what we've been collaborating with. But helping each other, like, I can't look at this thing anymore, Jim. Help, you know, take a look at this and talk to me a little bit. So I defer to him to say, and I walk around my studio with my laptop and I can show him things in progress and I can talk about The idea is where I'm like, what feels really solid to me and what feels kind of skinny. And he's able to, we can stop, we can look at those things. I know I'm not going to get an answer like, oh, that's really pretty, you know. I know I'm going to get something contentful, and I want a different way to think about this. And likewise, as I you know, look at what he's doing, sometimes I can talk about, I can also talk about the theoretical stuff and talk about the idea, but also I can come up with, I can look at something and go, Jim, why don't you use a 3/8?
That's too big.
Why don't you use a different lag bolt for that, Jim?
You know, that's also something I notice about artists from VCU. They go big or go home. The guy, lovely, lovely man, Ron Keller, who is in charge of the technical theater program at VCU, you take his stage class, and your final project is to create a set for a play. And if your set, if he thinks your set is too small, oh, you're making it bigger. No, you need to extend that. That needs to be taller. I don't see any intricacy here. I mean, it's a VCU thing of this largesse. Huh.
One of the things that I see in that environment as well is coming out as the, there's a lot of labor involved in what you're doing. And it's almost like the labor becomes a badge of having gone through some gauntlet of, yeah, I've worked this thing, and I've worked it, and I've worked it, and I've worked it. And when you get past that, it's been very interesting, because Steve and I have both been saying for the past month or so, saying, I can't see what I'm doing. I really can't. I can't see it. I have no idea what this thing is. And we've both been working really hard. But it's, you know, Steve came into my studio last night, and I was like, man, I don't know what this stuff is about. You know, I've been pushing it so hard.
But you do know what it's about. Mm-hmm. But I think there's different, well, here's that word we were talking about before, about perspective. You know, the perspective that you have towards this ta-da exhibit supersedes, or has the potential to supersede, the process and the ideas that created the piece. And you know what those are, but it's like, well, gulp, here I am on the big stage now, and what was I doing, and should I just sing the song? Or am I going to be able to present this in a way where I can still, I mean, we know what the ideas are.
So it's some minutes after the hour. We don't know where this is going to be played in our actual show. But if you're tuning in now, you're lucky, because you're listening to a great conversation with our guests, Steve Fishman and Jim Respis, talking about their exhibit that's about to go up at McGuffey on 94. And you're talking, and you're listening to us on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Something that I note.
January 8th, Friday, second
it's
Friday.
The opening.
Second Friday, not the first Friday.
Not the first Friday.
First Friday is the day after New Year's. We're not doing that.
Yeah, that's... That should be. That's definitely an artist holiday.
Is there going to be some drinking going on over there? Is that what that is?
I think that there will be wine available, certainly.
So, looking at some of the pictures that you guys brought for us, it's interesting to hear you talk about process so much, because something that strikes me with both your works is how can I say this? A lack of finality, and that's not, and I don't mean that by, oh, they're not done, but that in looking at them, it feels like that I, as the observer, have to do work to bring them into focus, to put them together, that they are presented in such a way that they really force me to be active.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The ideas, are, I don't want to tell you how to look at this thing. I don't want to tell the viewer what to feel when they look at something.
But I definitely have to figure it out.
Sure. But I think we're trained that way in a lot of different ways, you know? Like you, I don't know, for a lot of viewers, if you see an obtuse film that doesn't pull the string that brings it all together until the end, halfway, you know, through most of that experience, you're going, huh? Like what? I don't put Labrador retrievers with ducks in their mouths in my works. I mean, I want the works to reflect a kind of personal inner, almost an inner psychology. It's like a deepness of what things feel like, not what they look like. The camera can do that for us.
One of the things that I've realized in finishing the work for this show is that the sense that I've gotten to is that if I'm doing my job right, my job as I conceive of my job, then I'm setting up an interesting question for the viewer that is a relationship between an image and a form. And there is a middle ground between the image and the form, and there's a conversation between those two that the viewer then has to repeat. It's the conversation that I'm in, but then the viewer has to engage in that same conversation.
Nice.
And what I'm not clear on at this point is the pace of that discussion. And I've been having that discussion in my head for so long that the words and the shape of the conversation is clear as a bell to me. What I don't know is whether that conversation between image and form, materials and idea, is getting through to the viewer in a way that is engaging. I think it is. I hope it is. But that's sort of, I don't know. I'm not going to know until, I don't know, 6 months from now, probably.
But I think that's something that every artist, whether it's visual art or, you know, Clinton and I as actors and writers, we all have that problem. I mean, especially as writers, you know, you sit down with a set of ideas with something you want to convey to your audience through the creation of these multiple people. And they are conveying your ideas because, you know, it's impossible to create a character that doesn't have some of you in it. And then you have to, you know, do all this work ahead of time and get it on its feet and get it in front of people. And then you wait for them to tell you if you were correct or not.
Right, right. And I think that's, I mean, I like to talk about and think about the detrimental effects of the lack of artistic education in our culture, that is to say, how poorly we teach people how to approach art and how to deal with art and how to perceive art. I think a lot of people don't understand.
Bingo.
Yeah. I think a lot of people don't understand that, I mean, certainly one thing that you can do is present a nice little package that's all tied together. And certainly in the theater world.
A pretty picture.
Right. And certainly in the theater world, there are a lot of pieces, so many pieces where there's a lot of emphasis on what's the story? Are we telling the story clearly? Can everybody get the story? Is everything immediately apparent right there, right at that moment, so that they don't have to work? Because we know they don't want to. But there are some pieces, there are some performances, there are some things that you do where, like you say, you're casting out the nets to the waters. It's a conversation, and it's a complex thing that you're trying to put together. And one of the pieces is the reaction of your viewer, and you don't get that until you actually get the viewer. And so these, as you say, process.
One of the things that I see in this conversation is, you say that the education system doesn't make it possible, doesn't teach people how to think about art. And I think it goes to a bigger issue, the discomfort with not having a direct answer and floating right. in that space right. of, oh, well, I've got to come up with something here.
Right, because I've seen people get angry at me. I've seen people get upset, saying, "Are you intentionally trying to confuse me? Are you trying to make me feel stupid?" And I think that's part of it's that fear underneath it, that this is something that they should quote unquote get, that they don't quote unquote get, and somehow that negatively reflects upon them.
When I was still teaching at a small college in North Carolina, I had a student who I was talking about a painting, and actually I think it was a naturalistic painting, and I saw this guy look at me and he just said, "So what's this one supposed to mean?" And I was like, "Wow, what do I do with that?" And I'll spare you what I did with that, but I think I tried to take him to a more thoughtful place. And I think one of the things that's most important is the viewer in any kind of artistic endeavor has to be willing to accept the pacing, to slow down their awareness to receive the information that they're observing, that they're experiencing. And if you're waiting for another episode of Cheers, or if you're waiting for, I don't know, the Master of Light, that Kincaid guy, then you're basically you're ordering pastry in a Howard Johnson's.
Well, I mean, I think what's happened to a lot of American artists, audiences, is that they're waiting for the resolution. They are always waiting for the end of it. It's like, okay, you've taken me on this journey. What's my conclusion? What am I walking away from with? And I think a lot of artists are starting to create work where there is no resolution, where each person that views it is making up their own conclusion, and that makes audiences really uncomfortable.
Well, the thing that I would throw in at this point is that I think that question, Steve, that you got from the student is actually a very good question. And the trick in the teaching process is finding a way to have the student realize the ramifications of their question. I mean, it's a great question.
Right, yeah.
What is this supposed to mean? Well, it's like the questions that kids ask. Why is the sky blue? It's a great question.
Right.
It's a great question. And the fact that we can't answer it.
Well, and the thing is there's always two answers, right? There's the logical answer. There's the scientific answer. There's the process answer. But then there's the artistic answer. There's the philosophical answer that's a little more wiggly and depends on who you're talking to and what time of day it is and what mood they're in.
And evocative, too, because it suggests that any question is based on a perspective, and that perspective can take you into a specific place or cycle it back into a more thoughtful, reflective place.
So I love that you guys talk about pacing, because we just had a couple weeks ago, we just had Daryl Rose on our show talking about
sure.
his exhibit at the Jefferson School.
Sure.
And his stuff is very layered, and I was saying to him, I asked him at what distance he thought was the optimal distance to look at his stuff, because I told him of my experience of, you know, I was looking very closely and seeing all of these little details and all of these things that he'd worked in them, and then just not by accident but not intentionally, I turned around to look at stuff across the room that I'd seen before that I thought I'd seen before, but now, from across the room, suddenly it was resolved in a different way, and I was seeing different things from far away. And his response was, that's good. That's good that you did that. So many people don't take the time to slow down and see things in different ways from different perspectives. And he's talking exactly, I think, what you're talking about, the pacing of the work.
What is it that, I forget the story where the guy was talking about, you know, you look at the painting for a while and then you realize that the painting's looking at you.
Yeah.
And it's a different relationship, you know. And one of the things that I do in some of the classes that I teach, I use a De Hooch painting of a Dutch interior in the 17th century. And De Hooch was a painter of the Reformation. And it's this sort of scene, this very quiet scene of an interior looking out, and you're looking through a doorway. And I have my students describe this work, and we go into it, and we spend about a half an hour. And then in the middle, or towards the end of this, what they begin to realize is that the center post of the doorway and one of the crossbars that's a little bit further in space forms a crucifix. It's a perfect crucifix. And it's such a great experience because when that happens, the conversation in the room goes, what? Oh, wow. And I swear to God, it happened that way for me years ago, you know, and you all of a sudden realize that this is not just the depiction of an interior space. It's the depiction of a culture. And it does that in a very conscious way, which is, and at that point, and what I've heard from students that have gone through this, you don't forget that. You don't forget that this object is more than just a representation. It's a live thing that you interact with, which is cool.
Well, guys, really cool. Thank you so much for coming on our show. This was this is one of the most fun conversations that I think we've had.
Oh, yeah,
about
definitely.
Our longest time. So, Jim Respis and Steve Fishman, Fragmentations, recent works by Steve Fishman and Jim Respis. Tell them where they can see this and when they can see this.
It's at the McGuffey Art Center. The show is actually going up tomorrow.
Tonight. We're hanging it tonight.
We're figuring it all out tonight.
Which will have been a week ago by the time people are listening to this.
Sure. But then the opening is on
January 8th, Friday evening.
At 5:30. So come on by and have fun.
Great. Can't wait to look at those pieces and can't wait to have those pieces look back at us.
Thanks so much.
Great.
Thanks, you, man. Guys. It's sure. Great.
Thanks.
All right. Well, that was our interview with two wonderful artists, and I hope everybody goes out to see them. And you know what? We are out of time.
Are we?
We are out of time. But we had two awesome conversations today. I am seriously proud of the show we have done today.
So am I. I think we should be. We want to thank our wonderful guests, Michael Clem, and of course Steve Respis and Jim Fishman. Please check out their stuff. Check out as much stuff as you can. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Charlottesville's Institution, the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Rick Moore. Today he's got his guest Sarah Ellis from the Shelter for Help and Emergency. This has been Homegrown, a show about local art. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.